From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I was asked after Maya Angelou died, if I had ever cooked with her. And I said, of course, yes, I had, and did an article for the New York Times.
That's food historian Jessica Harris talking about cooking with poet Maya Angelou. It's a story Harris has included in her memoir, My Soul Looks Back.
I was talking with my editor about what the next thing would be after High on the Hog. And we started talking about all sorts of things, lobbed some cookbook ideas over the net, some other things. And then at the end, I just sort of offhandedly said, oh, by the way, have you seen the article that I did on Maya Angelou in the Times? And she sort of said, I don't really think I have, but it sounds like that's probably what your next book should be. So that was how it started. And of course, as I say in the book, her death got me really, really thinking about that period in time and those people.
So let's talk about those people in that time. In the 1970s, it included James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, and it all stemmed from this relationship you had with Sam Floyd, who was Baldwin's one-time neighbor and friend.
Absolutely, and actually is down in his official autobiography as his best friend. And some of it was through Baldwin and through Sam, and some of it was also because I was working at that point. I was certainly teaching, but along with the teaching, I was working at Essence Magazine. And so I don't remember, actually literally don't remember, whether I met Morrison first through Baldwin or through Essence. So a lot of sort of the bold-faced names came through Essence, and a lot of the really, you know, sort of enduring friendships came through Sam. He was the director of faculty and curriculum and also an English instructor at the Sikh program in Queens College, which is a part of CUNY, where I worked then and, in fact, still work now. My mother had worked at Queens College, and I have a master's from Queens College, and had been offered a job after graduation in this very new program. And I said, well, I've been accepted to go to graduate school in France. It's going to be a year. Can you hold my job for a year? And they said, sure, fine. And so off I went to the Université de Nancy to get a licence S lettre. And my mother was still working at Queen's College, so she would go by periodically and bug Sam. My daughter's job is still there. My daughter, you know, sort of that kind of thing. We taught together, and just one day, riding home or walking behind him on the way home to the bus stop to get the bus to the subway, we started a conversation and ended up going over to his house. He only lived about 3 blocks away from me. I had no idea. Gradually, that grew into a relationship. And that's how I met Sam. And through Sam, I met everybody else.
In the book, you talk about how you were so much younger than some of these people. So kind of paint us a picture of what it was like to be a young woman, coming of age, working your first jobs, trying to express yourself, and being thrust into a group of incredible talkers. I mean, I can only imagine what the conversations must have been like.
Well, there's several things that obtain. One, I refer to myself as the tail of the kite, or hanging on to the tail of the kite of their friendships. Gosh, I was in a state of perpetual awe. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I was a kid. Angelou was 20 years older than I was. Sam was 15 years older than I was. Baldwin was, I don't remember exactly how many years, but it was more than a decade. It probably amounted to a generation. So that they had, if they had children, children who were my age.
So did you use, I'm just curious, because I know that in my own life, being a kid, I used food a lot as a way to slip into situations that otherwise would have made me very uncomfortable. Was food that for you?
I'm not sure that food was that. I think in some ways, French may have been that. I think food was something that we shared. It was one of those few places in which I could almost be an equal, but then certainly the unfortunate incident, shall we say, with Georges Garin, which is in the book, taught me how much I didn't know about food.
So was that the choucroute garni incident?
That was the choucroute garni incident.
Oh, I love that. Could you tell that story?
Well, you know, fresh out of college, full of myself, in my very first kitchen, a galley kitchen in a Greenwich Village apartment with a brick wall, I had perfected, I thought, choucroute garni. I had studied in France, so I could pronounce it correctly, and I'd eaten all manner of variants of it, ranging from the one that came in the tin in the Prise Unique in France, the one at the Resto U, the university restaurant, to probably at that point, maybe one or two actually really good ones had in a brasserie somewhere. But my version was sauerkraut fresh out the bag, or the can, several francs.
Like frankfurters, like hot dogs.
Some scrubbed and maybe quartered potatoes, a can of beer and a glug of gin for the juniper, because I knew it should have them. But that was it. And I sort of served it up roundly, proudly, and out of the sort of ersatz Le Creuset pot that I had to a gentleman who was a two-star Michelin chef. He was unbelievably generous. He said nothing. I think even went back for a second helping. And then at some point thereafter, you know, in the following week, came up with a bottle of juniper berries. And I don't know how he found this, you know, small jar of juniper berries, but presented it to me and said, "You might want to think about adding a few of those the next time." It was all he said. It was so amazing.
How did you meet him?
Well, through Sam, and actually through Sam and through Baldwin, because his wife, Mary Painter, had actually been very, very important in Baldwin's life. In fact, another country is dedicated to her. And the thing was that, of course, because I spoke fluent French, Garin and I kind of hit it off. And, you know, he had a really kind of quirky, very Gallic sense of humor and loved to eat. And we would go trailing into some of the grand French restaurants in New York back then. And that was sort of a point in time where the French restaurants were betwixt and between. I mean, they were still coming out of the, you know, La Cuisine Classique, that grand French dining. And there were places like, you know, La Côte Basque and La Grenouille and La Caravelle we ate at several times.
I mean, just hearing the name of those restaurants, it's like, wow.
But to go in there with Georges was just another experience because, of course, they all knew him. I didn't have any idea what that meant until maybe a couple of years later when he actually invited me to his restaurant in Paris. And then I was so blown out of the water and so absolutely mortified about the choucroute.
It's such a lovely story. Nina Simone, did you ever meet her?
Oh, yes. Her first words to me were, "Who's the bitch in the red dress?" And they weren't really to me. They were probably more about me. And we didn't know then, or I certainly didn't know then, what we now know about her, that she was, in fact, probably bipolar. I was so in awe. I had, at the time that I met her, owned probably every album, because we're talking about vinyl back then, that she'd ever recorded. To be young, gifted, and black was like the theme song for my generation. There she was. And I was, of course, across the room in the red dress.
I'm so curious, when did your interest in food shift to studying it as a discipline, as a culinary historian?
Well, I mean, I think that was significantly later. I didn't even realize what I was doing until I was doing it. After my first cookbook came out, the first one being Hot Stuff, a cookbook in praise of the piquant, I was just doing what I did. And because by that time I had a PhD and had done research and was sort of academically oriented and trained, that was how I knew how to approach things. So even though I was working with recipe, I was also reading Columbus's diaries and Marco Polo's travel journals and things of that sort. And it was with the second book, Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, that Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who I'm sure you know, came to my house to do an article about me for something that was called Cooks on the Map. And in the article, she said, Jessica Harris is a food historian. And it sort of was almost biblical. You know, if you name it, you kind of have to be it. In the beginning was the word. After that kind of almost laying on of hands, I then went on to try to do that which I was told I was doing.
And who were some of your peers at that time in the discipline?
Wow. When I was admitted into Les Dames d'Escoffier, it was the same year as Betty Fussell and Priscilla Martel. They had all written more than I had at that point. Those were the kind of people who were out and working when I started.
Could you just describe for us one evening during that formative period of your life? Tell us who was in the room and what you were eating and what the vibe was.
Oh, good Lord. At Sam's house, anything could have been on the record player. He liked Esther Phillips, From a Whisper to a Scream. That album particularly resonates because of the time period, and I very much remember folks would sit around and in some cases deconstruct songs, you know, and sort of talk about the meanings of them. Junkie walking down the highway, I'm on my way home. What would we be eating? We might have had takeout from El Faro's. El Faro's reputed to be the first Spanish restaurant in New York, and they used to serve food out of, you know, the clay terracotta cazuelas or out of sort of little aluminum tins.
Which was so exotic then.
Oh, very exotic. And they had things like, you know, pollo al ajillo, which was just garlic-infused, fabulous chicken that was amazing. And they did a caldo gallego that was to die for. Just a rich, hearty, comforting soup that was almost a stew. I remember one Christmas, Sam decided he was going to cook a goose and worked on that. One day, I decided I was going to make a terrine. You know, we were all very involved with cooking, or at least Sam and I were. And I, you know, sort of went out and bought the terrine and then, you know, got the bacon to line the terrine and the meat ground and all. Oh, it was all a muchness.
So I do have to ask, when you cooked with Maya Angelou, what did you make and who took the lead?
Oh, she definitely took the lead. And we cooked several times. The first meal that I had with her, she cooked completely. I had no participation in it whatsoever. It was, in fact, before I wrote cookbooks. That was at her house in Sonoma, and it was very much a performance. It was a virtuoso tour de force. And that was a curry. I don't remember if it was an 8 or a 10 boy curry, but it was a very amazing performance is the way I would categorize it. Many decades later, we would cook together after I had written cookbooks. And we did it on a couple of occasions, certainly once at her house uptown in Harlem when she lived there. I think we made something with chicken. I don't remember what we were doing. It might have been a chicken salad. But I remember that she used to, just as a matter of course, keep cooked chicken carcasses and chicken in her freezer that would be taken out and, you know, defrosted and then ready to assemble whatever you needed to assemble from it. I know that the last meal that we cooked together was actually a chicken salad. And at that point in time, Maya had aged and wasn't really doing much, but she was directing the performance or the production. And, you know, people would bring the chop this, the chop that, she'd taste, and then we'd gradually assemble and then taste. And then it was determined that something was called for. It wasn't quite there. And at that point, she asked for regular old ballpark mustard, a little bit of that in, and voila, it was perfect.
That's Jessica Harris. Her latest book is a memoir called My Soul Looks Back. And this old world is a new world in a bold world for me. Next, we get a primer on Southeast Asian food from the daughter of a spice merchant. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
My mother was a spice merchant, and they came many years ago from Trancoba, which was a Portuguese colony, and then to India, from India to Burma, and then from Burma to Malaya.
That's the former Malaysian food ambassador to the United States, Christina Arokiasamy. She's here to school us on Southeast Asian dishes in her new cookbook, The Malaysian Kitchen.
So they brought with them 5 generations of spice trade and the artistry of making spices. So that was what I was used to growing up as a spice merchant's daughter.
Given that the cuisine of the islands is this collection of different traditions, is there a palette of spices that is common throughout?
Absolutely. When we look at Malaysian cuisine, for many people who don't know what Malaysian cuisine is, it's a cuisine that's based out of spice trade. Many centuries ago, you've had the merchants from India who've come and made Malaysia their home, Malaya then, and brought with them the coriander and the cumin, the turmeric, and these became part of the cooking repertoire from the Indian pantry. And then you also have the people from China, the salt merchants mostly, that came from southern China and brought the woks and the soy sauces like soy and sesame sauce and sesame oil, oyster sauce. These two ingredients have become part of Malaysian cuisine. And then a fascinating culture, the Portuguese, that colonized Malaya in the 1511. And when they stayed back, a whole new culinary community was born. And people don't get to hear about this community. It's called the Kristang community. They still exist there. And this combination of Indians and Chinese and Portuguese in that region formed a beautiful amalgamation of flavors from borrowed ingredients. And that is Malaysian cuisine.
What spices are known as the Three Sisters?
You know, that's something I came up with because they just look so well together. They are cloves, the little nail-like looking spice, and unopened flower buds, one of that. And then star anise, which provides you that gorgeous licorice-like flavors to pilafs and meat dishes. And then you've got the savory sweet flavors of cinnamon sticks. So the three of them, just they work so well together. They are the perfect trio for meat dishes and rice pilafs and anything hearty like soups and gravies and braised dishes. You definitely want to look out for the Three Sisters.
Are spices treated in Malaysian cooking the same way they are in Indian cooking, where they're usually tempered first?
No, that's the beauty of Malaysian food in the sense that it's a very straight approach. For instance, in the Malaysian Kitchen cookbook, you'll find that anyone in an American kitchen can cook with this recipes because you don't have a long list of spices that you need. Basic spices, you know, cinnamon cloves, nutmeg, cumin, coriander, star anise. These are the spices that go in, and then little spice powders like chilies and turmeric, and that's it. The food is so approachable, and it's this kind of spices that you can literally have buy in shops everywhere, and it's very direct approach. And it's great for people that love healthy food and food layered with spices. They can cook this without having to have a hole in their pocket.
Describe what rasa is.
You know, rasa is actually a Sanskrit Indian word, and in Malaysia we use it too. It's called taste. And I think taste has everything to do with food in you. Think about just your palate. You've got sweet and sour and salty and spicy. And then you've got savory and one hidden flavor, which is the umami. And rasa basically means having the diner, the person who eats, say, being completely satiated, completely satisfied. So sometimes and oftentimes when you go out to dine, you find the food maybe pretty salty or sweet. You're left imbalance, you know, you're craving after that. Your palate is actually craving. It's a psychological thing. You're craving for something to appease the kind of flavors that you didn't get maybe from your food because it's just sweet and sour or salty and spicy or sweet and spicy. So what rasa does, it brings the food together and it touches every part of the palate, sweet, sour, salty, spicy, savory, a tinge of bitterness, and that umami. So the palate is really happy. And for the diner, after they've had this dish, they're not craving. It's a complete satisfaction of eating. It's like, oh my gosh, I've just taken my palate through a party. You know, it's just a celebration.
Describe a dish from the book that you think exemplifies this idea of rasa.
First of all, there's many. I would like to say the sambal potatoes for the people who love potatoes. You've got the sweetness from the palm sugar. You've got the saltiness from salt. And then you've got the savoriness, which potato itself has that flavor, the main ingredient. And they got the spiciness from the chilies that we're going to use, and then the creaminess from a little bit of cream, a coconut cream that brings that whole dish together. So you've got all that flavors that's going in, and then turmeric, little turmeric powder perhaps, sprinkled on the top that can be added to this dish, forms the savoriness or forms the fifth flavor, the umami. So when you're really enjoying this, the sambal potatoes, or you're enjoying the chili sesame prawns, ginger sesame chicken wings, you'll see that there's all these combinations of the sweet, sour, salty, spicy going in. And it completely represents the complete way of eating. So you're really not searching for something that's missing in the food. It's just a complete way of saying, oh my goodness, I am so happy. Every part of my palate has been taken care of.
You use the word sambal, and sambals are seem like they're the salsas of Malaysian cuisine. How are they built? What do they begin with, and what are some variations?
Today we go to the stores and we see all kinds of chili pastes, right? So the sambals, I call them like the salsas of the Far East. So you've got a variation of salsa. The basic salsa would say chilies and vinegar, the sambal uliks. So you take some chilies, put them in the blender. The traditional way would be chopping them up and putting them in a mortar and pestle and grinding them away, pulverizing each chili to smooth paste. But you have the friend, which is the blender. You put them in with the chilies in, with vinegar and salt, a little bit of sugar. You then literally press the button and you've got this raw sambal paste. Now, from here, the step is taken to make variations of different kinds of sambals. So if you put it in peanut oil or canola or olive oil and just pan fry it, the oils will start to separate. So now we can add tamarind, a tangy ingredient. And now that sambal is lovely for fish. And then the same sambal, the basic chili, salt and sugar and vinegar, can meet with coconut in the pan and then cook that too till the oil separates. So that's delicious for seafood, you know, like fish, like tilapia. And then you've got green chilies. You can do the same thing with green chilies and garlic and shallots. So it's a combination of these dry aromatics coming together and then just cooking it until the oil separates, the moisture from the shallots and the chilies have given away. And then you've got this beautiful rustic red hue of color, complex, flavorful, sweet, a little hint of spiciness, savory, and a little tart and a little salty as well. And it's like peanuts, you know. So Malaysians use it on our dishes. We put it on rice, we put it on meat, we stir fry it with chicken, we stir fry it with vegetables, we add it to pasta like noodles, we add it to potatoes, fish, put it in a pot with chicken and some stock and forget about it, braise it. You've got an amazing amount of meals just starting with the sambal.
Because there's so much borrowing from the different cultures, culinarily speaking, can you describe a dish that maybe is more on the Chinese side?
Yes, of course. I would love to say the braised pork belly with a cinnamon nutmeg sauce. Oh, it's so delicious. Even thinking of it, it makes me hungry. So it's braised pork belly with cinnamon nutmeg sauce. If you think of that, and there's another dish, the Hokkien fried stir-fried noodles with prawns. in southern China, a lot of those days when they wanted to flee the country, many of the factory workers made the noodles. And so when they came to Malaysia, fled China to come to Malaysia, they wanted to repurpose the same kind of noodles which they were making in China. So after work, the Chinese workers would gather around the factory and over hot charcoal, make a quick meal with dark soy sauce and the yellow noodles that they've eaten back home with whatever repurpose, you know, that they've had from home or prawns or vegetable. And this Hokkien mee has become so popular in Malaysia. It is like the go-to to Chinese cuisine. And I have that recipe in the book and a very easy way to approach it. Then they've got the braised pork belly. The Chinese also brought in the love pork. So it's cooked in a braised style with all the kinds of pantry sauces you find in the Chinese cupboards. Soy sauce, sweet soy sauce, sesame oil, and oyster sauce. But then because they are in Malaysia, and because of the Indian influence, the Indian neighbors' cupboards had cinnamon and nutmeg. That got pulled in into the Chinese cuisine. So what you might not find in China, you'll find in the Malaysian Chinese cuisine. And it's such a beautiful experience. People will love this.
That's Christina Arokiasamy. Her latest cookbook is The Malaysian Kitchen. Pick up a copy to learn how to make Southeast Asian food at home. Now it's time for the weekly restaurant review from Jonathan Gold. Hi, Jonathan. I hope we're having something that's going to make your throat feel better this morning.
This throat thing has not gone away.
I'm sorry.
But we're going to Cosa Buona, which is a pizza parlor.
And who's the chef?
This is the new place from Zach Pollock, who we know from Soto, who has the fantastic Northern Italian Alimento in Silver Lake, and whose newest project this is.
It's interesting. I mean, he sort of kept part of the name. The old restaurant was Pizza Buona, and now it's Cosa Buona. Are we going to, of course, order the pizza? And if so, what kind of pizza is it?
The interesting thing about it is Zach Pollock has, you know, impeccable credentials. And you would think that he would be doing sort of a riff on a pizza parlor. But he's doing a pizza parlor. It's supposed to be like a perfected corner place. And instead of having elevated, you know, vegetable dishes or strange dishes from like southern Italy, you go there and the marquee item is probably the mozzarella stick.
I love that you are telling us to go eat mozzarella sticks.
They were so good. I've gotten out of the habit of mozzarella sticks because they're so awful.
They're so awful.
But this is great cheese. He lightly smokes it. He breads it in something that I'm imagining has like a bit of cornstarch. When it comes out of the fryer, it has that incredible crunchiness. So when you get into it, there's that goopy, smoky, flowing cheese. It's glorious. There's like a marinara sauce, which is like everybody else's marinara sauce, except also sort of a perfected marinara sauce.
I love that. We have permission to eat childhood foods.
He has garlic bread, which is more of a bruschetta, but okay, we'll let him have it. There's something he calls sotole, which is that collection of pickles that everybody growing up in the 60s and 70s used to eat with their pizza.
And it was called giardiniera.
Exactly. He obviously spent time cooking in Naples. And there's a calzone on the menu, which is homage to Franco, which is to say Franco Pepe, who owns the pizzeria in Caiazzo that I've probably gushed too much about on the show. It's interesting that so many people in town are sort of using this one pizzeria in a village as the touchstone. But the pizza is probably closer to, by the numbers, Neapolitan than some others. But it's also something that's like extremely good neighborhood pizza place in New Jersey or something, right? There's that burnt garlic smell to it that you almost never get in like actual Neapolitan pies. There's a crispness to it that, again, you don't find in Italy that much. I mean, when you get the marinara, it's going to be soupy in the middle because there are some things you just don't mess with.
What are some other toppings that you had?
He does possibly the only acceptable version I've ever had of Hawaiian pie.
Now, I have to say, I really like Hawaiian pie. I don't know why. It seems like I shouldn't.
There's nothing in theory the matter with when you get, like, with really great, fresh, ripe pineapple. This takes it, it's almost using the pineapple the way that you would use, I don't know, a salted vegetable or something, right? It's sliced really thin. It gives it a tang. There are chilies on it, so the tang of the pineapple, like, rhymes with the chilies. And they use Canadian bacon as their ham thing. And the effect is almost Yucatecan. It's not Yucatecan, but there's a lean in that direction. I really like it. I don't want you to think that that's the pie that I would get every time I go there. The best pie is probably the one with really good sausage, sautéed mustard greens, and a little bit of chili. It's just the pizza that you want when the word pizza flashes into your head.
I look forward to going. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Glad to be here, Evan.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is eating pizza and mozzarella sticks at Cosa Buona in Echo Park. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. In a minute, we spend some time with a guy who opened a bakery at the ripe old age of 76. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. When I was at the James Beard Awards in May, one of the most moving moments was when Mark Furstenberg won for Outstanding Baker. Accepting the award, he thanked his sons for dealing with a father who decided to open a bakery at the age of 76. The audience went nuts. The bakery is called Bread First, spelled F-U-R-S-T. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Evan. I'm sorry to drive people nuts. I don't mean to.
No, in a good way. Everybody so happy. There was so much joy in that room.
That's very sweet of you to say.
Well, I think the beauty of your remarks is that it's good to remind folks who are toiling through their first entrepreneurial experience in their 30s that life continues to offer opportunities, no matter how many iterations you have to go through or how old you are.
And even tolerate mistakes and give you the opportunity to start again after having made those mistakes. Yes.
You weren't always a baker. How did you find your way to the oven?
I ran a manufacturing company in Reading, Pennsylvania, and got so much joy from the manufacturing process. I, like most Washingtonians, had done government, and I had been in a police department, and I had worked for presidential commissions and even for the White House. But there was something very special about watching copper tubing rolling off the finishing line, so beautiful, like jewelry. And then I came back to Washington and started to write for the Washington Post, and I had good assignments and no complaints, whatever, but I wasn't happy. I wasn't feeling as I had felt in Reading. And I reached my 50th birthday. My sister gave me a party in her backyard, and in my memory, no one came to it. And a couple of nights later, I went out with my old friend, Barney Frank, and I was moaning, complaining, whining, and he got angry with me and yelled at me, "Stop it. People who lead high-risk careers like people like you and me have bad times as well as good times. What, do you expect everything to go well in your lifetime?" He hurt my feelings, but he was right, and I began to think about what I wanted to do. And since food had always been my hobby, since I had always prepared food, and I thought, that's what I'd like. But I didn't want to do something that simply involved selling somebody else's product. I wanted to make something. I wanted manufacturing in my life again. And my sons and I handed out questionnaires in a neighborhood in which my sister had opened a bookstore. And when the questionnaires came back, People said, we want bread. I used to live in Brussels. I used to live in Amsterdam. I used to live in Paris, and we had wonderful bread. Why don't we have bread in Washington? And I thought, I can do that, which was ridiculous, of course.
But it wasn't ridiculous because you did it. You taught yourself how to make extraordinary bread. What was the name of that first business?
It was called Marvelous Market.
And you ran that business for how long?
I ran it for a few years. It was a sensation. It got a lot of attention from people who lived in that neighborhood. It was in the newspapers frequently, and television cameras came to show the bread lines in Washington. And people offered me a lot of money to expand it. I was an idiot, and I took that money and expanded it before I knew what I was doing. So over the next 3 years, I lost it.
And you've had a few iterations. Now with Bread First, you're concentrating on manufacturing on a smaller scale.
Exactly. I turned around after having sold my restaurant downtown, a block from the White House. It was popular and well-received, and I was proud of the food. But I reached an age at which I thought it was time to retire, and so I sold the business. And then people began saying to me, as they had said 15 years earlier, why is there no good bread in Washington? I don't get it. Why is there no good bread? You had good bread. There's no bread in Washington. And then my sister died, my older sister, who had opened a bookstore when people said neighborhood bookstores, local bookstores will fail. They cannot succeed. They cannot compete with the big box stores. But she opened one, and it became a fixture in Washington, and it still is. And when she died, I thought, I shouldn't let it go now. I should try again. I should try to create a neighborhood store that would serve this neighborhood the way Carla served it with her books.
And that's Bread First.
And that's Bread First.
At 25, you worked for the Kennedy White House on policies to combat poverty. What do you think about most when you think about that time of your life?
Oh, it was very glamorous and full of an idealism that no young person feels any longer. It was a time to be in Washington simply because we thought we could do good things, because we believed in government, because we saw problems in the country, and we thought we could use government to try to help deal with those problems. The food wasn't so good here. It was pretentious and ordinary, but it didn't matter. What we had in this city was a cult of idealism, and it was absolutely marvelous, and it will never come again in my lifetime.
Talking about your own personal life, you've said that your mother may have never turned on a stove until after the war. What influence did she have on your life?
There were two people who influenced me in food. One was my mother, because she learned to cook when she had to learn to cook. She had come from a family whose matriarch did not cook. She didn't have to. It was a more or less upper-class German-Jewish family in Baltimore, and we had a cook. My mother's ability to learn cooking, even under wartime rationing, was certainly an inspiration very early in my life. And the other one was my grandparents' cook, a woman we called Bobbly. She wasn't very long removed from family slavery. She had come from the Tidewater on the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, and who knows how much education she had. But she was a strong woman who ruled the kitchen and who had a great imagination and appetite for cooking. My first summer job in college was as a camp cook, and then I returned to the little town in which my college was located and became a short order cook. But I don't want to tell you, Evan, that I expected to follow a line into cooking. Those were jobs I liked, but I didn't expect to become a cook.
Describe to us a bread that you have on your menu now that you would like to share with us.
That's hard. We make the best baguette I have ever made, and I never eat it. We make a ciabatta-like bread, which we call Paladin's bread, named after Jean-Louis Paladin, whose reputation you knew well. But the breads that I find myself drawn to are the corn rye, the teff and rye mixture. I think we make a very good croissant, authentic and good, and we make other good pastries. But the bread I think that I find myself most drawn to is the range of whole grain breads that have never been immensely popular in our country.
I think they're finding a footing.
I do too.
How many times have you been nominated for the Beard Award before you finally won?
Well, I was nominated twice as best chef in the Mid-Atlantic, which I surely was not. You know that this award for bread baking is a new award. I am the third person to win it. I was nominated all three times for that, so I was nominated five times.
So what did it mean to win?
I knew you were going to ask that. I don't think I'm the best baker in America. The award isn't for that either. It's for outstanding baker. But others who were nominated at the same time I was and in the two previous years were as deserving as I, at least. And then many who have not been nominated deserve the award as well. What it meant to me was that we had been succeeding in my aspiration to create a neighborhood bakery that might become a model for other neighborhood bakeries in Washington. The neighborhood was already so happy with this, complimenting me every day, and I mean literally every day, saying, "We're so glad you did this in our neighborhood." And then when I won the Beard Award, it was a kind of validation for them. They thought we were good. Now they knew we were good. It shouldn't be that way. I think it is that way. I think they're very proud to have this bakery in their neighborhood, whereas before they were just happy to have it.
Mark, how lovely to get to take this time to talk to you. Thank you so much.
I thank you, Evan. It's wonderful to talk to you again.
That's Mark Furstenberg. His bakery in Washington, D.C. is Bread First. He was honored with the James Beard Award for Outstanding Baker last May. Now let's travel to Portland, Oregon to talk with Jamie Curl. She started out in the baking biz, but now owns a candy company called Quinn.
It's not that I sort of got to one morning and was like, well, I think I have reached the end of the possibilities of a cookie or a pie or a cake. I just sort of started making candy to see if it could sort of reignite in me some excitement.
And so it did. Curl started with caramel, then moved on to lollipops, making a point of using what she calls real ingredients.
And the day that I sort of turned an Oregon strawberry into a lollipop, I was completely hooked on candy making.
Now Curl's candy company is thriving. She's the author of a book that features her recipes called Candy is Magic. What do you think should be the very first foray into this new experience of candy making?
I think that if you have not made hard candy or a lollipop, that that's a really great place to start because it is relatively easy and the outcome is so amazing because you really take this kind of hot liquid and turn it into something that stands up on a stick and, you know, is like crystal clear and beautiful where you can see little bits of seeds of the fruit that you use in it. So I think it really, a hard candy or lollipop builds confidence that you need to sort of go on to do these other trickier things. With a lollipop, it's super simple. Starts out with three ingredients in a pot that get cooked to, you know, around 315 degrees. You add a little bit of fruit or some flavor, and then you pour it out and you let it harden, and then you have this magical candy on a stick. For some reason, caramel is this thing that holds the most fear for people. So I think starting out with something a little friendlier like a lollipop is a good way to build that beginning confidence.
So what are the three ingredients?
You start out with sugar, glucose, and water. And obviously the sugar is the sugar and the water sort of helps the sugar to melt a little bit. And the glucose is an ingredient that I like to call an interfering agent because it keeps the sugar from recrystallizing once it has melted and kind of is responsible for that beautiful, clear, nice, translucent look of a lollipop that's sort of perfect and allows it to sort of have a hard snap when you bite into it instead of a more crumbly, crystallized texture that the sugar would have. So, you know, in a lot of mass-produced candy, that's where high fructose corn syrup comes in or just regular corn syrup. But The glucose that we use at Quinn, my candy company, is derived from a potato and comes from France so that we can ensure that it's GMO-free. And it's just a very, very necessary ingredient in candy making.
So one of the things I find really intriguing about your approach to candy is living in the Pacific Northwest as you do and having access to really beautiful fruit and berries like we do here in Southern California.
Yes.
You manage to merge this sugary practice with farmers market ingredients.
Yeah. And that, I think, comes from the way that I developed all of these recipes was in a bakery where, you know, I was surrounded by fruit that we were putting in baked goods. It never crossed my mind to find a substitute for the real thing. I just started out using real food and never strayed from it. And it wasn't anything that I decided to do to lure in customers or build a business or to hit some sort of like natural food thing. It just was what was obvious to me that I would use in making candy. And it didn't really strike me that it was this different thing until I looked at sort of the collection of candies that we had come up with and was like, these are so beautiful, the lollipops especially, that you can see like little bits of cherry skins or a strawberry seed or a blackberry seed in it. And that is when I sort of clicked that I was like, okay, this is, you know, what you did just by instinct is this thing that is pretty amazing. And all of this stuff is going to be so beautiful for customers to look at and photograph so beautifully. So that all kind of sort of came second. And I just like to use the best ingredients that I can get my hands on. And using real fruit was the first step there.
Occasionally when I help people organize parties, I will bring in a cotton candy machine.
Yes.
I always think to myself, there has to be a better thing to pour into this machine to make something wonderful, but I never realized what it was till I opened your book.
Oh, yeah, you can use really any hard candy that you make. You can put it in the cotton candy machine and it will spin it into cotton candy. And this is something that we learned when I was working a food festival and I partnered with a winery and I was talking to them about how great it would be if we could figure out a way to make Pinot Noir cotton candy. I just worked and worked until we made this sort of Pinot Noir hard candy that at the time we kind of ground down so it would be a little bit powdery and put it in the machine and it worked. And then it was not until after that event that I realized you could just put small pieces of hard candy in the machine and it spins it into cotton candy. It is like truly magical because it can be any hard candy, whether it's commercially made or something that you make yourself, anything.
Gumdrops. What are they?
You know, we have lots of different feedback on gumdrops. And a lot of people really like sort of a pâte de fouille, sort of a gummy fruit confection. Whereas what we make are gumdrops that are not as hard as sort of like a Brock's gumdrop that maybe you would buy around Easter time, but is a really bouncy, buoyant, gummy, fruit-filled candy, but is not a gummy bear and is not a gummy worm, but is sort of a little bit, there's a little bit more bite to it, I guess is the best way to say it. So it just depends upon, I think, where you were raised and what you're accustomed to eating that you think is a gumdrop. Like, you know, is it a spice drop that's a little bit smaller and a little bit tougher? Or is it something that is almost like a jam that has a little bit of a, you know, bite to it, the texture that sort of holds itself together? It really depends. So, and what we make are, it's a candy that is gummy and is filled with fruit. And I do use gelatin in them because it achieves the sort of bounciness that we want and also allows us to put as much fruit in the candy as we'd like. So we, you know, bring in fruit like we talked about earlier and we roast it and puree it. And then we use that fruit to color and flavor the gummy candy. And the using the gelatin in it allows you to use more fruit yet still hold its shape without becoming weepy or, you know, melting inside of a package, which you would never want to have happen because I have seen it and it is sad.
You have this thing that you call magic dust. What is it and how do you use it?
It's a mixture of high quality cocoa powder, sugar, and some spices, cinnamon and salt, and some vanilla bean powder in a perfect ratio, in my opinion. And you just mix that up and you keep it in your pantry. And with it, you can make brownies, chocolate cake, chocolate sauce, hot fudge, chocolate marshmallows, chocolate whipped cream, ice cream, pudding, a million things. It can become this sort of the chocolate and the sweetener together, from baked goods to creamy stuff. It's just the best.
Jamie Curl owns Quinn in Portland. Her new book is called Candy is Magic. If you want to see pictures of her gorgeous confections, check out her Instagram feed. It's Quinn, Q-U-I-N, Candy, all one word. We close out the show with a report on stone fruit from the farmers market. That's after a quick break. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
There's nothing better to me than like a peach that you bite into and it just bursts in your mouth and, you know, the juice runs down your chin and it's got a high acid and high sweetness to it. It just feels like summer.
That's Justin Hilbert, the executive chef at Maud in Beverly Hills. He's hanging out with Laura Avery this week at the market and they are talking about peaches.
I'm finding so many peaches that I can't even remember all the varieties of them. There's so many and they're all delicious and I can't wait to use them all in the restaurant. In the restaurant at Maud, we do a 10-course tasting menu based on one seasonal ingredient, whether it's peaches or melons, which is coming up the following month in September. Last month was basil, you know, so we try and get as many varieties as we can and do as many things as we can with them and consolidate it down to a 10-course tasting menu. So for this month, I'm really excited because I'm getting peach leaves from Stephen Murray, and we're making an ice cream with those. We're fermenting them. We're getting peach wood from Orchard's Best. We're going to grill with that in a nice fruit wood flavor. And then all the different varieties of peaches we find, like the donuts, the yellows, the low acid, everything is going to fit into a certain dish, and it's going to be very important that each peach fits into a certain way in each dish.
You're tasting all these first, right, as you walk around?
Of course. Yeah, that's why I come here to get my breakfast first and then do shopping for Maud later.
How many peaches would you say you taste on a Wednesday?
At least 15 to 20 different varieties, which is great.
Well, the thing about the peaches, and the farmers are the first to tell you, is every single week they're going to peak and then they'll drop off. And so the same variety maybe one week won't be quite at its peak the next week. Tell me what you do with peach leaves.
I'll be making ice cream with them. They're very, very bitter. We're fermenting them. We're actually making a green curry with them, like a Thai-style green curry with a mortar and pestle that's going to go in a pork dish that's grilled over peach wood. We get a little crazy on some things, and some things were super simple, like we're going to do an amazing peach melba. Just simple as that. Some things are very involved. Some things are very simple. It's kind of a nice flow of a menu where you get some things that are, you know, blow your mind away and some things you can relate to as a child.
Right. Everything from childhood except for those nasty cling peaches in the can with the sugar syrup.
Actually, no.
Uh-oh.
An old sous chef I had in New York figured out a way to set the pectin level so you have that texture of a canned peach, but it tastes so much better because it is a fresh peach. So we're actually doing that with the cheese course, which I'm really excited about because it has remembrance of canned peaches, but tastes awesome. So I'm really excited about it.
Okay, now what do you do with the skins? Do you just take the fuzz off or do you peel them or a little bit of both?
What's wrong with the skins? They're delicious. I love that texture, that like firm, fuzzy skin under that juicy peach. You don't like it, do you?
Not personally, but I think a lot of people do want to peel a peach or at least wipe the fuzz off.
Well, depending, you know, how ripe they are, it's kind of hard to peel if they're too ripe. But we are also using unripe peaches or not so ripe for certain applications as well. But those we peel, we coat them in beeswax, and then we let them ferment. So they're super effervescent after 10 days, and we put that on a dish. So we try and do as many things as we can to manipulate the peach and then also keep them as they are naturally and as beautiful as they are naturally.
Right. So, that was executive chef Justin Hilbert from Maud Restaurant in Beverly Hills. And the whole month of August, Maud will be featuring 10-course tasting menus featuring perfect California summer peaches. We have about a dozen farmers in the four Santa Monica farmers markets and probably throughout LA or more who grow peaches all over California. I'm talking right now, though, with John Tannarelli, who grows in Little Rock. It's actually in northern Los Angeles County. And John, you have just delicious peaches. You are well known. People make a beeline to your stand for your peaches. Tell us, first of all, how many varieties you grow. People are always amazed at how many there are. And then tell us what you really like that's going to be in season in August.
We grow probably about 25 varieties of yellow fleshed peaches and another 10 or 11 varieties of white fleshed peaches. And we stagger them all, so you always have a fresh fruit on the table each week.
How long on average does one variety last?
We'll have one variety for an average of 2 weeks. Every 4 days you pick a variety, that's 12 days. Right now our ranch is 102 degrees every day. Can't leave it out there. What we do is we pick them, we put them in an air conditioning room at 75 degrees to ripen them 24 hours, and then we either sell them or refrigerate them down to 34, 35 degrees.
What happens to the peaches if they're hanging on the tree in 102 degree heat day after day?
If they're ripe, they need to be picked because they're going to soften. But if they're not ripe and you get temperatures over 102, the trees actually shut down. The stomata on the undersides of the leaves is shut down and they just kind of go into dormancy. They don't ripen. They just kind of sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the temperature will come down in a few days, then they'll progress into the ripening.
When you say they're ripe, it isn't that they're soft, it's just that you know they're fully ripe, basically, what, by the color?
You look for size, color, and then feel. When you pick a peach, there is a little feel. Feel it's not rock hard. It's just a little different feel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes experience to learn how to do that.
And you're not squeezing it with your thumb and forefinger. You've got your whole hand.
Your whole hand's on it, and you can feel it. The minute, you know, it's just a, you know, experience.
So it isn't just push the top, the shoulder at the top to see if it's ripe.
Yeah, not while it's on the tree, no.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, but when it's, you know, it's on my table, you can push the shoulder in with your thumb, a sharp edge of your thumb, and it'll smash, and then you know it's ready to eat.
Then you better buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Don't put it back. Okay, but your peaches, you can help customers. I mean, without even touching, you can help them select the best.
Right, right, right. And I always tell them to take the prettiest peach. The ones that have that pretty color really got the nutrients to do that. You know, that side, real intense blush color on one side of it, yeah.
When it's 102, are your pickers, what time in the morning do they start?
5:30 in the morning.
Okay.
And they're done by 1:30. The guys are used to it. The guys are singing in the orchard. They're having a great old time.
And you're at how many thousand feet?
3,000 feet. You know, it's a little cooler at night. The fruit can hang on the tree a little bit longer and develop more flavors. And, you know, people say that our fruit has just a little special more flavor than everybody else's. And that's from that high altitude.
That was John Tannarelli. He's a farmer, one of the few located in Los Angeles County, and very, very well known and beloved for his peaches. He'll also have apples in the fall. And love having John and tasting his fruit week after week. It changes every 2 weeks, so you got to stay on top of it. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery. Keeping me tight, taking a bite out of the peach
tonight. I like the innocent time. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team, especially Abby Swanson. The rest of them are
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more good food.